Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. Hello, welcome to 2023 and to this special episode of the Nowhere Office in association with PwC UK on generative AI and the regeneration of work. I'm just going to turn to the camera for those watching. I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
And I'm Stefan Stern.
And our guests in full frame of the camera, even if you can't see them, are Kevin Ellis, the Alliance Senior Partner of the UK and Middle East of PwC, i.e. one of the absolute top honchos of PwC, and Gina Neff, who's Director of the Cambridge Mindaroo Centre for Technology and Democracy. Mindaroo has got to be the best name of any organisation, Gina. It sounds like Deliveroo, but we're going to come on to that. And just to be clear, Mindaroo, the MCTD as it's called, runs an independent team of academic researchers looking at digital society and its impact on the planet and on people. So, Kevin, PwC is interested in the planet, people too. What's the business take on what's happening with AI as we start this brave new year?
Well, I think this time last year we were heading off to Davos, and I don't think anyone really had taken too much interest, as much interest on ChatGPT. I remember going to a presentation by Satya Nadella there, which was packed. And the kind of view in the room was that if you're not part of this, this is a real fork in the road moment. If you look at really what's happened since, it has just multiplied. And I think for a business like mine, yes, we're purpose-led, but we have to be a business and we've got to be relevant. And we recruit 4,000 people a year, and I often meet a lot of those new joiners. The first question is, will AI take my jobs? The second question is, will I get access to it? So if you're wanting to be a magnet for talent, and we are a people business, that's all we've got, we need to be relevant. So if we're not investing and training that talent, giving them access to that, both from our apprenticeship staff right the way through, then we won't retain and be able to recruit the top talent in the future. So it's about remaining relevant. But there's been many forks in the road, just like last year, coming up this year, and no one's got a crystal ball. You just got to make sure you're part of it.
And this time last year, and I was at Davos as well, and I remember those sessions, but the emphasis was on jobs. And in fact, a big report was put out saying that roughly 25% of jobs globally will at least shift. A lot of them will become green jobs. There won't be a net loss of 25% of jobs. So, Kevin, what is your sense about the net gain loss bit of the discussion about AI before we get into the generative AI in the workplace?
No one's got a crystal ball. I think I read that article by Carl Frey from Oxford. And I think one of the points in that is very relevant, that most of the jobs in the US today didn't exist in 1940. So I think with the job market, it's not about absolute numbers. It's about agility and adaptability. You know, we've created hundreds of jobs around AI because we have to, because it doesn't just happen by itself. You'll need to have people creating it. I think you can over-index on what happens with jobs. I mean, I'm sadly old enough to remember the laptop computer coming in, and we had loads of estimates here at the time about how the job numbers were before. We employed 16,000 people then. We employ 26,000 people now. So I think the types of work people do will change, and the jobs people do will change. Whether that's a net loss, I don't think we know yet.
It's tasks, not jobs, right? Tasks change, yeah. Activities change. But Gina, come in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the best economic estimates we have will be a net job gain. So this comes from the International Labor Organization and the OECD. Economic estimates globally suggest net job gain. However, that doesn't mean the transition is going to be smooth. No. For everyone, we're going to see task composition change. And that can be good news for some, but it absolutely means we have a transition to manage. And to manage that smoothly means building human capacity, building infrastructure, and reimagining what our lifelong learning process actually looks like.
Totally agree. I mean, you know, when I started work, we used to talk about kind of education, work and retirement. Now it's lifetime learning. And I think some of the technological changes we're experiencing now, have experienced, but it's even going to get quicker now, is going to mean everything is about lifetime learning. And it's about actually making sure that we democratize it. We don't have all of the smart people at the end of one corridor that you have to go to for information. Otherwise, that is not going to democratize it and make the world we're in now even more the haves and have-nots.
Well, that's a really dangerous position.
It's not going to work because I'm finishing a book now called Negotiating Innovation. And it follows the process, 15 years of digital transformation and high-end building construction. And you can have that smart technical talent at the end of one hallway, but at the end of the day, you need construction workers on site able to make the thing happen. And I think it's such a metaphor for what AI is going to do to our work, because we need people in construction, retail, hospitality, name the sector, who are smart, confident, and able to work with the systems and able to work smarter.
Well, there's an interesting interview on this podcast with Dave Eisenberg of Zig Capital, the prop tech company that we ran at the end of 2023. And he cites an example of a company they invested in for construction workers, where the AI enables them to have cameras embedded in everything they do so that the walls of a building speak long after it's been built. So there are, I mean, can we just focus a little bit on the optimism of the capabilities. Gina, are you an optimist? We've had Alice Thwaite, the techno-ethicist philosopher, who's pretty gloomy about AI and society. But some of the advances are miraculous.
I'm a professional pessimist and a recreational optimist. So my job at the Menderes Center for Technology and Democracy is to make sure that we hold tech power to account, that we are using the advances that we have today to better the conditions for people, communities, and the planet. That if we're not taking those values-led approaches to digital technologies and transformations and change, we're missing out and we're missing the opportunity. And that's part of the job that I have. I'm an optimist, however, because I think there's an extraordinary human capacity for entrepreneurial growth and ideas and excitement. And you see that, again, not just in the C-suite, right? You see that on the ground. You see that with people coming up with new ways of working and new exciting ways of making things happen. And if we empower people to do that, we can get there.
So you're a techno-Gramscian. You've got optimism and pessimism playing out together in the AI world.
I've never been called a techno-Gramscian, but I'm going to take it. That's my bio right now.
I'm slightly techno-Fordist, although I'm sure some people are going to hate on me and point out all sorts of terrible things about Henry Ford. But I'm reading the history of the Ford Motor Company pretty closely at the moment. And, you know, the car was just so revolutionary because it opened the world of work and leisure. And it feels, Kevin, to me that we are at an inflection point now where who we are as individuals in our lives and who we are as workers at work, we're using the same technology a bit like we use the car, only it's not as tangible and physical going from A to B. It's surrounding us in the cloud and in the software and in the AI. Is that a reasonable comparison to make? Or
I think it is. We see it also with the new joiners. I mean, they're joining our organizations with this technology available to them day to day. So they're not coming into work and getting a new technology. They're expecting a technology that they've already acquired off the internet, used in the school and university, to be available to them. So we're, you know, at the same time, there is also a danger that the generation, my generation, who have been less brought up in that technology, get left behind. So again, that kind of, if you like, being the fairness around this, the equity around this, we've got to make sure that as an organization, we will only be successful if we make it available to all. It goes to Gina's point about the end of the corridor. We've got to make sure that the more people that have the opportunities for the use of technology, the better we'll be as an organization. That's my priority.
And you talked about democratizing, and the word democracy is actually in the title of your organization. But this business of information flows, people coming to work, they're on TikTok or on the tube, and then they're coming into the office, and we want sort of, quotes, adult professional behavior. How do you manage this sort of information flow and interaction of generations in this fast-changing technology?
You do have to have controls around it. But you can't ban it. when it came in, a number of countries banned AI, as did a number of organizations. You can't do that because you're not going to stop them. It goes to, you can't ban the motor car once it was invented, going to your Ford analogy. Yeah. So you've got to make sure you have the control and the guardrails around it to control people. But at the same time, you've got to make sure you're adapting your organization. So the way I would say is that what AI will do, I suspect, is reduce a number of the analytical tasks and a number of the selection tasks. A majority of those tasks will probably be in the more junior people in most organizations. Yeah. But again, it's a key plank in the training of those individuals. So you can't bring everyone in at manager. You've got to train them to be a manager. So for us, how you adapt to that is, we'll say, and the line I use is, it's a bit like taking people to year three in year one. You're going to have to find ways of getting people through, because the menial, I'll say the photocopying, but the menial tasks that we all started on and we learned our way into the office on are going to be removed by technology and now AI even faster.
I think that's right. I mean, I began my career photocopying an 800-page manuscript on sports injuries. I can never forget the tedium. But Kevin, you're spending, I think, about $1 billion on...
Globally, yeah.
Globally on AI literacy and usage. And you said something that I think is really salient, which is that the office will be the place, or the workplace, but let's call it the office for the purpose of the Nowhere Office podcast, will be the place where people come because of the technology. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about media, media is very paywalled. It's quite undemocratic now how you access media. The Guardian and the BBC are pretty much the only free-to-air media. Technology is getting a bit like that, isn't it? If you don't have the Wi-Fi password, if you don't have the broadband, if you don't have... So I just wonder what both of you feel about the raw tech enabling people to access information and systems, as well as getting the work done.
There's been a conversation in the UK around where are our foundation models, the underlying large language models that will help UK businesses grow and succeed. And in some ways, the UK economy may be on the back foot compared to the investment that's just available in other markets. I won't name Silicon Valley, but I'll name Silicon Valley. We might not be able to catch up in terms of making that investment in the models themselves, but there's an extraordinary opportunity for the kinds of services that are built on top of the existing models. And there's an extraordinary amount of work that is needed to make AI and generative AI work for goods and services for small, medium enterprises and also for large companies. So if we're gonna make applications and build on that application level, we have work to be done there. Simply banning these technologies, saying to people, don't use them, doesn't prepare our workforce for the things they need to be able to do to open up those new opportunities.
What about training to that point, Kevin? Because America is actually on the back foot in terms of its infrastructure, and the Biden initiatives are trying to pull that round, but it's uneven, isn't it? Whereas we in the UK are talking about skills and technical colleges more than they are elsewhere. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think it goes to what Junior said earlier. It's not necessarily going to be a net job loss, but it's going to be a massive retraining. You can't move from job A to job C in a nanosecond. You've got to be retrained.
But so, who's doing that? Well, Is government doing it?
I think there is an issue with investment in the UK. I agree with that. I think there's an interesting fact here, though, that we're very strong on the professions in this country, like pro rata. We're heavy in the professions, and the professions are big training grounds. So the majority of our investment, the billion you spoke about earlier, is actually not in building tech. It's making sure people can use the tech. Mm. It goes from my 3 years to 1 year. Mm. We've got to make sure that the people that we employ and want to retain and want to develop to be the leaders of the future have the skills. So nearly all our investment is in the retraining. And it's interesting, we're just about to launch a CEO survey that comes out at Davos. And it's interesting that I think the UK CEOs, 48% of them said that they're using generative AI, which apart from Japan and some Scandinavian countries is at the top end. Mm-hmm. And interestingly as well, I think about 48% of UK CEOs also thought their job numbers will go up.
Yes.
So it's quite interesting that the training and adaptability. Well, it's partly a reflection. I think it's partly a reflection of the types of economy we have in the UK, yes, which is more service-led than some of the others. And you've got to do that at the front end, haven't you?
We launched a report just a few months ago at the center on what UK policy around generative AI should be. And we basically said double down on the fact that the UK is great in services and we punch above our weight in ethical AI. So if you make a list of AI leaders in the world, US and China are at the top of that list. And UK is widely understood to be third. But if you make a list of where is the research and development and services being developed around so-called ethical AI, responsible, transparent, accountable, ethical AI, the UK is clearly above that third spot. So we're either number one or number two, depending on how you do the accounting. So there's an extraordinary opportunity in this country to essentially help build the kinds of applications and services for generative AI. And that can be done here, and that can be done with those foundation models that are existing.
And how do we keep it human, to return to Homo sapiens, you know, flesh and blood and so on, people, because we're still going to have people. We don't want everyone to be disrupted all at once. How do we keep this discussion grounded in human realities?
Well, I think we have to keep it centered on what people want to do and what people will do. I'll tell a little story. I was chatting with someone around the AI Safety Summit, and this young AI expert just very confidently said to me, oh, you study the future of work. Well, you know, when we get to general AI, right, when we get to general AI, we will no longer have work.
Oh,
and I said, oh.
This old chestnut.
Yeah. I said, when will that be? And he said, exactly 8.5 years. And he said this with this confidence. And I just thought, you don't have children. You don't care for elderly parents. Yeah. You don't get goods and services across the country. We've got a lot of work that's still going to happen. So I think we have to stay really focused on what people do and what people need for society.
But that's an ethical thing in itself, isn't it? I had exactly the same conversation, actually, with the great, brilliant Mustafa Suleiman, whose book has been the big hit, who's a co-founder of DeepMind, Google's DeepMind. But he has gone on the record frequently saying, you know, we're not going to need jobs, and that's great. And I'm saying, I've had a conversation with him where I said, hello, I don't actually think that's true. All right, of course you want to, you know, eradicate some of the more repetitive tasks, and you want to democratize up and so on. But I think that's a really big ethical question, isn't it, Gina, which is, are the technology companies at risk of trying to do away with work because it's better for their profits, or are they accidentally and unintentionally stumbling around into territory they don't actually want to be in?
Well, listen, the technology companies are in the business of making the tech that excites and enchants us. Let's give them that. Again, if I'm going to be a professional pessimist, though, they are not in the business of making a good society. That's my job. That's the job of government. That's the job of civil society. We have an extraordinary amount of work to do to make sure these transitions are landed well.
But Kevin, there's got to be a middle ground. That can't be completely...
Well, I think
binary, surely.
Well, it's true, though, isn't it? My job is to run a business. We can't invest in people. We can't invest in technology if we aren't a successful, profitable business. So that is the priority. Now, you've got to make sure you bring in talent, and you've got to make sure you're purpose-led, because otherwise people won't want to work with you, or they won't like your brand. So there are controls around it, because if it was just pure profit above everything else, you wouldn't get any employees, because the average age of my employees is 31. We take a lot of them to school. They choose on purpose just as much they choose on money. So you've got to make sure that you're giving them access to technology, access to training, and they feel they're in a purpose-led business. Otherwise, you can't be a profitable business. So there are guardrails around it, but you've got to bear in mind that whether you're a tech company or you're a professional services firm, if you're not making money, you are irrelevant and you can't carry on investing. There are controls there, which is why Gina's correct in her view of government.
And academia. The Googles of this world for a long time have regarded themselves as being on the side of the angels. Do no evil. Do no evil. I mean, were they naive? They're making massive layoffs as a result of AI, by the way, as we speak. But I mean, I think I want to give technology companies some credit.
Be careful on layoffs, right? I mean, again, we work in a world where everyone's a little bit overforced. Force fed on other redundancies. We haven't seen unemployment go up in spite of what's been a very heavy headwinds in the economy, because we haven't had the labour force. AI will enhance the efficiency of the labour force and will remove some lesser jobs and more mundane jobs. So that will probably be a positive for people that didn't want to do those jobs. What we're going to make sure is we can retrain people so that they can do the jobs that are going to be needed to in the future. So I think I wouldn't say a company making layoffs. We've made layoffs. All companies make layoffs because you have to change your business at certain
times. No, I think the Google layoffs are directly related to the AI, as I understand
it.
And
also, we don't talk about when they employ people either. So you've got to be careful. It's a bit like plane land safely as a headline. It's never a headline, is it? So I think when people take on, it's easier to talk about layoffs because you can see the jobs that are lost rather than the jobs that are created.
But actually, my point about Google is coming back to this tension, which we always talk about on this program, don't we? Stefan, not just between the human and machine, not just between the employer and the boss, but the kind of humanity versus the progress of the tech. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get to, which is the tech companies aren't all venal and profit-led, but equally they're missing something, aren't they, Gina?
Well, the AI professor, Stuart Russell, has this wonderful metaphor. And he says, imagine that asphalt engineers come and say, we're really, really good at making asphalt. And so you should trust us on where asphalt should go. Your garden? Why not? The beach? That'd be a perfect place for asphalt. In fact, we're so good at asphalt. Just let us make all the decisions on where we use this.
Kevin's having a good old chuckle at that one.
Right? And this is precisely the kinds of conversations that I think up until the last year we've had around AI.
Yeah.
The tech companies know what they're talking about, and therefore, let's trust them. I did a project with Google for Davos in 2020. We weren't doing anything in 2020 around Davos, called the A to Z of AI. And it was an explainer, a primer around what AI is and isn't. And one of the things that we did was do a little survey, very quick YouGov poll on who do people trust for information about AI? And who was at the top of that list? The tech companies. Who was at the bottom of that list? We asked, your friends, universities. I think we have a huge choice that we have to make. We need to have different voices at the table around the kinds of choices that we're making, because these are choices about what we want for society and what we want for how we want to share in the benefits of this growth.
Well, we've been warned to guard against what are called hallucinations in generative AI, but I think we're all prone to hallucinations and imaginings and false imaginings and understandings. And we've got to be very careful that we are grounded in reality, in human reality.
Since we've been talking about techno-Gramscianism and techno-Fordism, that sounds like techno-false consciousness. That sounds almost like techno-Marxism.
But I think what you end up with is no one can do on their own. It can't be done by academia, can't be done by governments. It's got to be done by a combination of business looking to make a profit and recruit people and train people because they need them, with government and academia creating the guidelines. I mean, that has to be, because if you just had a world led by government university and no one investing, you wouldn't have any development at all.
You and PwC has always been a big convener, hasn't it? That's always been, as far as
I
understand,
part of our business model, yeah.
Part of your business model and education and sort of, if you like, corporate education. Gina, you wanted to come in.
I was going to say, I'm part of leading a program called Responsible AI UK, which is a £35 million investment by the UK government, in part to do that joined up thinking around how do we connect what's happening in research, what's happening in industry, and how do we bring civil society and government along with us on that journey. And we've been in touch with PwC to help be a partner in that. So I'm gonna come back to Kevin and
love it. A little bit of business round our table.
Look, one quick one. I mean, I think the other things on AI that we've got to bear in mind is that, it will improve accuracy, both in our work and...
When I get the transcripts of these podcasts, some of it's pretty out there,
know. Yeah, but also the accuracy in terms of doing work. I mean, we will have a definitely more accurate in terms of, like, it's just like you're doing an audit. You can take out 100% of the data rather than the sample. We know from the healthcare area some of the people who have had their cancer treatments enhanced significantly by AI. So AI helps in many different ways as well.
I just ask a check and balance point then before we sort of round up with your predictions as everyone is coming up into the Davos season and the New Year resolution season? I mean, in the UK at the moment, regardless of when you hear this program, but in January 2023, Britain is revisiting a huge tech scandal.
Is that 24?
24. Oh my goodness. Sorry. In 2024.
Britain is revisiting a tremendous IT tech scandal called the Horizon scandal involving the post office, in which 700 odd employees or so were falsely accused, some imprisoned, some died, over a failure of technology which the governance structures simply didn't see. So I guess we do need to balance pure technological risk here, don't we? You say that it creates better accuracy, and I know what you mean, but what happens if it doesn't?
Well, then you're back to culture and governance, right? No organization can operate without strong culture and governance, whether you've got AI or not. I always say that you can have the greatest culture in the world, but when you get a bad apple, you'll need the governance to remove the bad apple and recreate the culture. And again, I think when you see these failures, AI isn't going to replace that. AI is not going to replace leadership skills, and nor is it going to replace culture.
Does it take people's eye off the ball, Gina?
It can, and we have research and we have mechanisms for doing that. But I will say, when we did with the Women's Forum for Economy and Society, when we did a series of interviews, focus group surveys, with CTOs and chief data scientists and their CEOs, we found those industries that were high accuracy, high performing, and regulated industries where they had to be able to explain their decisions to regulators were the industries that were most ready to take up the notions of responsible, ethical, transparent AI. So they were the ones who said, we know how we explain our decisions, and we have to be able to turn around and say that. And so they had those guardrails in place, and they had the culture in place to do that.
Well, I'm not going to make a prediction, but I mean, I remember John Garnett at the Industrial Society, when he was talking about work, used to say, there'll always be washing up. And I think the nature of these tasks will change, but some of the repetition, some of the task completion of work will remain the same. And I won't say that the voice recognition software will never capture our words properly, Julia, but it just obviously is struggling with our vocabulary. That's all we can say.
Okay, fair enough. My prediction is that our basic level of literacy around this new kind of technology is going to creep upwards significantly this year, in the way that it did when Google search came in the way that it did when word processing came in. But I don't think outside of, if you like, the elite businesses, we're going to see what in the UK we call Joe Public be more aware and utilise more, which is to your point, Kevin, about the professions. So that's my crystal ball. Gina, what's yours? And then we'll finish with Kevin. What's your crystal ball about this whole AI thing this time next year, 2025? What will we be saying?
In 2024, we will see, my crystal ball says, several high profile cases of generative AI being used in ways that puts people at risk and is dangerous. I think we're still very early in the adoption of this, of these tools, and we still have a lot of work to do in terms of building out safe services that people can use. So we've heard about the example of the attorney who turned to generative AI to prepare the legal brief. I think we're going to see some other big missteps there as people learn and experiment. That's not to say we shouldn't be experimenting, but I think we need more work to be done to get these tools to their full capacity. And that's what 2024 is going to be about.
I think I agree with that. And I also think that any of the good things that come about out of AI won't get the same kind of headlines. And at the same time, we'll still be talking about job losses, even though there won't be a lot of evidence of them in the next year, but it will still be the focus of most of the media coverage.
Gen AI plane lands safely.
Yeah.
On which note, onward safe travels. I know two people around this table, Gina and Kevin, are going to Davos. I'm finishing a book. Stefan, where are you going for the rest of January?
South London.
South London.
Assisted, sea level.
Assisted by generative AI or just?
No.
Excellent. Staunchly human. Thank you so much for joining us in this special one-off episode. You've had Twixtmas, now you've got Twixt series. We're between series 5 and series 6, which is going to come back in the spring. Thank you so much to Gina Neff of the Minderoo Centre for Technology and Democracy at the University of Cambridge. And thank you to Kevin Ellis, Alliance Senior Partner for the UK and the Middle East of PwC, and PwC UK for partnering with us at the Nowhere office, at which point audio participants won't see me turn to the camera to say goodbye. I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
Yes, and I'm Stefan Stern.
And you've been slightly watching and listening to a fully connected production edited in Miami by Kevin Hirshon. And find us in all the usual places. Subscribe, like, and of course, do so digitally. Thank you.